Now, Gunset. Bon matin, mesdames et messieurs. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. It's good to be with you this morning. Thank you, Ryan, for the opportunity to be here. Thank you, David and Linda, for the invitation to come here. It's great to be here. I'm really excited. My daughter, Janine, is with me this morning, sitting here in the front row. She's the youngest of our girls. I'd like to start by introducing my family a little bit to you and who I am, and I know that that may take a while, so I'll do the abbreviated version. I'll just take 10 or 15 minutes. I'm from the land known by our people as Mi'kma'ki. Some people know it as the land of the people of the dawn or the land where the sun comes to life. It's in the Atlantic seaboard. I currently live in Prince Edward Island with my wife, Bev. I'm from the district of our nation called Gaspésiq, which means the place where the rocks meet the water, and from a community from which I descend known as Listabouche. And it's right across from Campbellton, New Brunswick, if you're familiar with the Canadian geography of the Atlantic. If you find yourself on the map at Campbellton, New Brunswick, and you go across the Chaleur Bay or Bay de Chaleur, you'll find our reserve on the right-hand side as you get off the bridge. Back in the day, it used to be a ferry. You'll find the French community of Cross Point, and to the left, you'll find Listabouche, the First Nation community from which we descend. My wife, Bev, and I have been journeying together 44 years this fall as husband and wife. So I am, as the biblical injunction requires, the husband of one wife, it's been a treat to be able to journey these many years with her. And we have three children: Janine, our youngest daughter, her twin sister, Jennifer, who lives in Montreal, although she's migrating back to Edmonton in the near future, which her sister's excited about. Well, maybe a combination of excited and anticipating with some anxiety, wondering what that will all look like. And our son, Matt, who is our youngest. He's 36. He lives in the Philippines, where he leads an indigenous youth and young adult-framed community development mission. Our daughters both work in the indigenous community in various capacities. Jennifer at the University of McGill, working with students with disabilities, indigenous and other. Janine works as a researcher and writer here with the Native Counseling Services of Alberta. Once again, it's good to be with you. My name is Terry LeBlanc. You can ignore the DR period in front of it. I think those were little droppings from the Linotype ferry. I tend not to use those sorts of things. So this morning, I want to look at the passage that was read in Revelation with you, and then also look at something else. I'm going to turn this upside down. This is a modern smoke signaling device in the event that you're unfamiliar with it. They're quite helpful. So hopefully I can get this done right here. Just a minute here. Oh, there we go. So sometimes you get a little bit of too green a wood on the fire and the smoke doesn't come up really quickly. So you have to be careful of it. After this, I looked, and there was a great multitude that no one could count from every nation, from all tribes and peoples and languages, standing before the throne and before the Lamb, robed in white, with palm branches in their hands. Now, I don't know when you read that what you think about it, but the very first time I read this passage many, many years ago, it was in the context of coming to faith in the early 70s, during the Hal Lindsey, late great Planet Earth days, when there was a big hubbub about the future of the eschaton. The heavenly unfolding. Jesus was returning and all of that sort of stuff. This is the hubbub of Christianity in the prairies of Canada when my wife Bev and I came to faith in the early 70s. And so when I first read this, it was a thrill for me to think somehow there was this chorus of voices that would be heard in heaven and that my voice would be a part of it. Many years later when I read it with a slightly different perspective. You see, when I first entered the faith, I entered the faith as a person who had grown up outside of the church, though I'd been baptized three times. I was baptized as all of our people in Mi'kmaq communities are in the Catholic Church. And so I was sprinkled in the Catholic Church by the priest, and sometime later, my mother and my grandmother becoming alienated from one another. My grandmother, she was a crotchety old thing, came and took back her wedding gift from my mother. And so my mother, in retaliation, hustled us off across to Campbellton, and there found an Anglican priest who she failed to tell had that we had already been baptized. And so we were baptized by the Anglican priest, my brother and I. So we were poured. But I didn't grow up in the faith. I didn't grow up in the church at all. So I had no training about Christian faith or life, no training in the scriptures, no understanding of Christianity or anything of that nature. So when my wife and I came to faith in the 70s, we were invited to go to church. And neither of us having any church background, being pragmatists the way we were, coming out of the hippie era, we said, okay. And so we went to the closest one. It happened to be Pentecostal. And so the Pentecostal pastor, some months later, asked us about our history and so on and how we'd come to faith. And we didn't come to faith in a church, per se, but in a community group. And so he said, oh, well, you should be baptized. And so we were, in a swimming pool in Neepawa, Manitoba. So I was immersed. So I've been sprinkled, poured, and immersed. I have a Trinitarian baptism. But at the time that we came to faith, it was, you know, you fall in love with the person, the work, the life, the teaching, the death, resurrection of Jesus, and you want to just follow in after him, really enthused and excited about it, and you don't know anything about it, so you just follow the folks who had gone there before you. And so that's what we did. We just followed the people around us who were in the church. We persevered day after day, trying to figure out what it looked like. And of course, one of the things that became very implicit and explicit about the church is that there are certain things that people expect you to do and not to do, right? So when you enter into the church building, there are certain expectations, like with weddings. Weddings are wonderful times of celebration. You want to throw rice and confetti, but not in the church, right? So there are these sort of expectations. Well, there are other kinds of unspoken expectations that come along with entering into the faith when you have no history of Christian upbringing. And so some of those were things like don't drink, smoke, dance, chew, or go with girls who do, right? So there are certain sort of expectations of behavior. We talked about that a little bit in the Sunday school class, in the adult conversations just a little earlier. There are certain sorts of expectations you have. Well, some of those made good sense to us. Some of them you just sort of, I wonder why. But there are these other implicit and explicit expectations that came along as well. Some of them related to culture. Now, it may not seem like much to those of you who come out of a Euro-Canadian culture. As I look around here, that's most of you. But for somebody like me, it's like, okay. So there are these sort of cultural expectations, the way I dress. So I needed to get the right clothing. And in the church back in those days, in the 70s, it was still for men a certain conservative kind of dress, a suit and tie. Well, I didn't own such a thing. So I was inducted into Christian clothing. And Christian clothing back then was a three-piece suit. Silk power tie and wingtip shoes. So I went and got that because I wanted to be a follower of Jesus, emphatically wanted to follow Jesus. We fell in love with him. So I got myself the Christian clothing, and so did my wife. Nice dress and all of that sort of stuff. We were sort of hippie. Well, not sort of hippie. We were hippie. We met at a drug party. You know, that's where we met. Fell in love, looking to one another to meet each other's needs, not for companionship, but for a little weed. Didn't find it. Neither of us, we were both disappointed, but we started hanging out together and soon got married. Well, so there was those expectations about Christian clothing. So my Indian stuff, not really. Jewelry, not really. No jewelry. So one of the treats of my life is getting on a plane. I travel a lot. Getting on a plane And the first thing that happens when I get on the plane is the lead flight attendant, if she's a woman, although these days men do too, I think, would say, "Oh, I love your earrings." That's interesting for a man to be complimented on his earrings, right? But I've worn earrings for a long time. So none of that. No jewelry, no Indian stuff, no eagle feathers, no clothing, no cultural appurtenances, no cultural practices, no musical instruments, no song styles that are reflective of your culture. You sing Fanny Crosby, right? And back in those days, Fanny Crosby and the choruses that began to circulate in the day. Nowadays, it's Fanny Crosby and Hillsong. So today, to be authentic as a Christian, you got to be able to sing Hillsong. If you can't sing Hillsong, then there's questions about it. You know what I'm saying? I'm jesting, but there are these implicit and explicit expectations for us when we come to faith. Even if you grew up in the church, you grow up into these expectations. You need to look like, talk like, walk like, think like, act like, be like the rest of the folks in the church. And so as my wife and I entered into our faith experience, wanting to follow Jesus, watch these folks, listen to these folks, learn from these folks, and we soon began to realize that to be Christian was to be like them. And so we did. Numbers of years later, I realized the error of that. As I began to read these kinds of passages, Revelation says, every nation, all tribes and people and languages. Languages shape culture. They shape our way of thinking. They shape the way we engage with the land that we live on and the environment that we find ourselves in. And so there are cultural differences that grow up out of different languages. Tribes are people that are defined by certain practices, certain ways of looking, ways of dressing, ceremonial understandings of the creation of which they are a part. And they differ. And so I read that and I thought, oh my gosh, look at that. From every nation, we are a nation. The Mi'kmaq people are a nation. We come from Mi'kma'ki, the land of the Mi'kmaq people. It's our nation. And I realized perhaps there was more to it than simply dressing and acting and talking and walking like I'd been taught, like we had been taught. So here before the throne are all of these people of all of these languages. When I say good morning to you, nao gunset, sinwa, and I give it a bit of a lilt, the way that I would greet people, it's both a statement and a question, and I'm asking you, is the sun on the water? And you feature the Atlantic, the sun coming up over the water and the first rays strike the water, and that's the image that's in my mind when I say those words. And it's a different picture than when I say to you, bon matin, en français. When I'm greeting you in French, the picture is the church on our reserve, the Catholic Church, and very much like the stained glass at the back here, there's this ornate stained glass window right at the front of the church. And if you go into the church, right as the sun is coming up, the stained glass lights up in a particular way. And that's the picture that's in my head when I use those words. And when I say to you, good morning, in English, the picture is of me walking towards this brightly illuminated landscape ahead of me with indistinct figures of people. And I'm walking and my hand is beginning to come up as if I'm going to greet someone. That's the fleeting image that goes across my mind as I say those words in English. All three different perspectives because they come from different cultural contexts shaped by those languages. And as I read this, I thought, oh my gosh, look at this. God is inviting us. The creator of the universe, Gitche Niskam, Magat Niskam, Kesuk, is inviting us to come in our cultures and languages, from our tribes, with our songs, and with our dances, dare I say that. Now, I know in Baptist churches, dancing has been a problem. There are lots of jokes about it, some of which I wouldn't repeat from the pulpit. But there's dancing. Heaven is not the Philadelphia cream cheese advertisement. Right? Ladies, Albert is not going to wait on you hand and foot as you lay there in fluffy white clouds and he feeds you Philadelphia cream cheese. That's not heaven. Heaven is this place where we engage with the Creator of all things the way that he had originally intended for us to do so in the first chapters of the scriptures in Genesis 1 and 2. But now pushed out, fleshed out exactly the way it's intended to be. That's what it's going to look like. And here we are from all of these cultures, with all of these ways of thinking and being, with all of these different kinds of music, with all of these languages, singing. And I don't know how it all sounds, but it's harmonious as it offers to the one who made us all the praise that only he is worthy of. And focuses our attention down on his presence among us. And so as I looked at that, it's all about the future. And I wondered, how do we appropriate this in the present? And so I did what I do in every circumstance. I appropriated one of my grandfather's teachings. When I was a young boy, my grandfather, father, and I traveled some distance from our home community. We got on the ferry boat, went across from Listigouche First Nation to Campbellton, got in my grandfather's old beater of a car that he used when he was working for the New Brunswick government as a conservation warden. We traveled in the old car until we got to a place that we were going to fish in a spot that only my grandfather knew. You know, one of those only I know where this is kinds of spots. And so we parked the car at the side of the road, got out, got our gear and a little bit of a lunch, and we're heading in on the trail, my grandfather in the front, me in the middle, my dad behind me. It's the only day in my entire life I can remember where the three of us spent the entire day together. And so it's vivid in my memory. And as we set out down this trail, it's fairly wide as we begin, but it isn't very far in, and it begins to narrow in, and the trees begin to seem to close in on us. It gets dark. And as a young boy, just a little guy, I'm frightened, I'm anxious, and I tug on my grandfather's arm. Giscat, giscat. Nixkamich, nixkamich. Grandfather, grandfather, we're going to get lost. And I'm anxious that we'll get lost. I'm looking behind, I can't see anything. Looking ahead, and I can't see where we're going. The brush is closing in around us and so on. My grandfather leaned back and reassured me, and off we went again. My grandfather, me, my father, and not far down the trail, I'm anxious yet again. Several times this happens, and finally my grandfather stopped, put his gear down, turned to me, knelt down, and told me this one teaching that has lived with me all the way through. And he said, when you're setting out on a trail that you've never been on before, when you're going somewhere that you've never, ever been before, spend twice as much of your time looking at where you've come from, looking over your shoulder at where you've come from as you do where you're going. Because when you turn to take the trail home, the landmarks are going to look different. What was on the right will be on the left. What you step down off, you're going to have to step up over. The beaver lodge on the left will now be on the right, and it's going to look different. All of those landmarks will look different, and if you don't look at where you've come from, you won't be able to locate yourself where you are, and you will not be able to find your way home. My grandfather that day gave me the ability to find my way to and from all of the various destinations in life that would lie before me, all of which, as I set out on each new trail, were initially unknown. Contemporary societies, not just North American, are no longer used to looking at where they've come from. They're far more fixated on an as yet unknown future, on what comes next. And it's not just back in the Hal Lindsey day in the 70s, looking toward the eschaton. Today we do it maybe differently, but we're anticipating, planning for, developing for, working toward the future from this point in the present. Rather than use the past to help determine where we are on the trail in relation to where we started, Western-influenced societies plunge ahead, often blindly, expecting that the future will correct any mistakes they make in guidance. As far back as 1973, Dr. Carl Menninger, very famous psychotherapist, quoting Dr. Daniel Burstyn, director of the National Museum of Science and Technology, affirmed that we have lost our sense of history, lost our traditional respect for the wisdom of ancestors and the culture of kindred nations. We haunt ourselves instead with the illusory ideal of some whole nation which has a deep and outspoken faith in its values. Menninger went on to say that this loss was deeply rooted in our increasing ability to wink at wrongdoing, calling it something other than what it is, describing it in terms that are more socially manageable, salving of the conscience. The title of the book in which Menninger quoted Burstyn has a telling title, simply, "Whatever Became of Sin?" Interesting title. In 73, Menninger's work within the field of clinical psychology had witnessed the collapse of any sense in which humans sinned, describing antisocial and aberrant behaviors with euphemistic expressions like greed, poor socialization as a child, etc. If you remember the collapse of Enron, Ken Lay, the chief executive officer and chairman of the board of Enron, who was also the chairman of the board of his church, was described, together with his colleagues in senior positions of management, as having been victims of greed and corruption, of embezzlement, misdirection, and a whole range of other euphemistic terms to describe what Jesus described as the worship of mammon, idolatry. This is what Menninger was referring to. An interesting reflection. We might be tempted to say that was then, this is now. Time has moved on, were it not for the continuing studies of the human condition in Menninger's field of expertise. Gregory Boers, in his 2008 PhD thesis, observes, "We've lost our sense of historical thinking in modern times. And with this loss of historical thinking, or imagining historically, we have lost perspective, that is, an inclination to think in both breadth and depth and analyze critically. We must address at least two significant ways of losing our imagining of history. One is our manic focus on the present, so that the present becomes a defense against the knowing of the past. And what is past is concretized, placed in a literal framework rather than critically examined. The other is that we lose history through what has come to be known as biased historical knowledge. An example of this bias is a general written history of Western civilization that has excluded significant contributions of people of color. Again, we find memory the faulty mechanism in the keeping of historical evidence." Now, I say all that to say this. We're fixated on Revelation chapter 7 and what might be taking place there, and I think it's exciting. But in order for those languages and cultures and peoples and tribes to be represented there, we have to significantly change our thinking about what it means to be a follower of Jesus, culturally speaking. And we must look over our shoulders at where we've come from in order to do that, all the way back to the book of Acts chapter 15. Where in the book of Acts, in presentation at the Jerusalem Council, in response to those who would say, it is necessary for Gentiles to be circumcised in order to keep the laws of Moses. Believers from the sect of the Pharisees saying, it is necessary for Gentiles to be circumcised in order and ordered to keep the law of Moses. We have to look back to that conversation, because that conversation was about culture and the nature of culture in Christian faith. And the believers from the sect of the Pharisees were demanding that all of those Gentiles who were coming to faith must first enter into Judaism and become Jewish, not simply religiously, but culturally. And we can say that with confidence because we know that in Jesus' day, the Pharisees had constructed a very elaborate cultural, social, and moral framework within which Judaism was expected to be lived out. So in order to see that vision of Revelation in the future realized, we have to look at where the church has come from in order to understand where it's at, because today we still practice that same expectation that the Pharisees, the believers from the sect of the Pharisees did. When people enter into our churches, we more often than not, implicitly and explicitly, expect them to become like us. Not spiritually speaking, but culturally speaking. And if they don't look like, talk like, walk like, think like, act like, be like us, we are suspicious of them. We question the authenticity of their faith experience. Just the same way that the Pharisees did. And as Paul and Peter and Barnabas and others brought this case to the Jerusalem Council to have it decided, the Jerusalem Council made a very clear decision. And they said, it's not about Jewish laws and commandments and customs. In other words, it's not about Judaistic culture. Paul would reflect on this in Galatians as he spoke about the Judaizers who were requiring circumcision and the keeping of the Mosaic law. And by that, it's not just the Ten Commandments that Charlton Heston brought down off the mountain. It's about more than that. It's about everything that had gathered itself around the law of God. And the council said, it seemed good to us and the Holy Spirit. Actually, they reversed it. It seemed good to the Holy Spirit and us to lay upon these Gentiles no greater burden than these essentials. Refrain from blood, from meat sacrificed, from meat strangled, and from fornication. If you do these things, you will do well. That's it. Those were the cultural norms. And they were there to ensure fellowship, that the Jews who had come up understanding certain customs were important could be fellowshipped with by the Gentiles and vice versa. Had nothing else to do with the laws of Moses or any other commandment. Four things, and that's it. So, as we're inviting people to come into our communities of faith and experience the person, work, life, teaching, death, and resurrection of Jesus, how are we doing it? How open are we to their cultural expressions of faith in Jesus Christ in our communities? So if we want to see Revelation chapter 7 become reality, if we want to see that expression of faith in the kingdom of God in heaven, whatever that is, and whatever it looks like, it requires that we look at where we've come from. And how is it that we're engaging people of other cultures and cultural perspectives? So as my wife and I came to faith, we were expected to put off everything that we had from I burned every album that I had, my Beatles collection. Oh, tragic. I burned every feather and bead and everything that was of a native value to me, to us, over the years. We burned or we refused or declined for years. Because the Christian folk around us said, that's not part of what it means to be Christian. I didn't play drums. I didn't raise my children with their language because some went so far as to say your language is evil because it's not English or French or Spanish or German or Dutch. I wanted to be a follower of Jesus, and I still do today. But I understand today that it looks different than that. It's about me being the best of who God created me to be, and that's as a Mi'kmaq person. And it's about me living in my culture and identity that he created me in, not in yours. And it's about celebrating yours and mine together so that we can anticipate this gathering in heaven. That's what we're invited to do. But it's got to start by looking at where we've come from to understand how we got to here so that we can figure out as we move forward into that unknown and unknowable future that we do it in a good way. May God bless you.